Hello, I'm Jake Halford. I'm here with Dr. Aaron Graham, who is a British Academy postdoctoral fellow at the University of Oxford and a junior research fellow at Jesus College.
That's right.
And we're going to be talking a bit about history and what got you into your history. I guess, first of all, what got you into history? What made you choose history rather than science or maths or anything?
Difficult to say. I'd always enjoyed history, always been interested in looking at historical things. But I saw both as of interest quite long, really up to A level. I did a biology AS level, but just history always seemed the more interesting one, the more challenging one, and that's what I then took through to university and on from there.
Yeah, well, what made you continue doing history after you'd done your undergraduate degree?
Ooh, difficult to say. I suppose doing the undergraduate degree had firstly shown what an enjoyable challenge history was, the business of trying to unpick what people thought. And there were a lot of very interesting issues that came up as well, looking at the 17th and 18th century questions that I didn't really feel the undergraduate had answered. So I went on to a postgraduate degree, and then I still didn't feel the questions had been answered, and then the doctorate after that. And I'm still not sure I've ever been able to answer all these questions, but at least I feel I'm a little bit closer towards understanding them.
And throughout that, have you always been interested in the long 18th century?
No. My interests have ranged quite widely. And in fact, I started off very interested in the English Civil War in the 1640s, the 1650s. But I think for various reasons, I got interested in the 1660s and moved on from there. So I'd say certainly my main interest is the 1660s, but I'm also interested in the long 18th century, but I'm interested in things before and after as well.
I guess it's like all boundaries in history, they're always fuzzy, no one ever...
Exactly, and there's certain things that you really make no sense unless you carry on to the 1850s or begin in the 1640s, and I think that's the nature of every type of historical inquiry.
Sometimes I get the feeling that the start and end dates often are just arbitrary.
They are to a certain extent. There's certain landmarks which are necessary, and there comes a point always when you have to say stop. This is enough. But yes, and certainly as we as historians move into more complex themes, the old start dates of when monarchs die or when they accede are increasingly inadequate.
Yeah, I just don't find them very interesting. Like, who really cares when the king died? But that might be the Republican.
No, exactly. And also, if you're looking at economic and social history, then of course you can't say that suddenly the industrial era begins on this date in 1760 or whatever.
And so okay, this is quite a big question, but why do you think the study of history matters?
It's a big question. It's a difficult question. I think I'd say firstly there is an intrinsic value to studying history as an intellectual exercise. It is important to understand the past, and it deserves as a result to be studied through proper intellectual methodologies. This isn't something that can be just picked up. I'd say the second thing is that a lot of other scholarship, maybe in the social sciences as well, or in other areas of the humanities, relies on certain assumptions about history. There's a historicity to some of what's done. So what I know best is the history of state formation. And in the social sciences, it's not enough to look at what's going on at the moment. One has to see a lot of state formation as the outcome of historical processes. Now, what I hope as a historian is that my work is of interest to them, that it speaks to people working in other fields who are able then to use my arguments, my findings, and use it to enhance their own things. So there's, I say really two things. There's the intellectual merit of just studying history for its own sake, but also my hopes that history is useful to other forms of intellectual endeavour and to the wider public as well, who are interested in history and want to know more about it.
Yeah, so something I hadn't thought about before is the fact that, like as you said, in social sciences they have concepts that they're using, and all these concepts have a history.
Of course.
And you can tell that history in other ways, and that alters the assumptions they take to their work too.
Of course. And as historians, we generally have quite distinctive methodologies to what we do. I remember going to a conference with economic historians and historians studying economics, and to an extent neither of us really understood the other, because the economists are starting with a model and working down to individual cases, and historians are starting with individual cases and working up to a model, which is, you know, obviously a simplification, but that's what it felt like. And I think there was a value to both sides, to the historians being forced to put what we were doing into a wider perspective, but also for the economists being forced to say, well, this works as a model, how do we account for these very general cases?
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I certainly say that.
So what kind of methods did, like, what methods do you find yourself using in your research?
It's a difficult question. I use the methods that seem best depending on the type of source that I'm looking at. So, for instance, I do a lot of financial history, which calls for a certain amount of number crunching and working with accounts and trying to work out how money flows around. So that requires a certain methodology, one that I've built up used through examining this, but also looking at texts that, when I'm trying to recover the mentalities that come out of letters and diaries, that requires perhaps a more literary approach, one that takes advantage of certain methodologies from other areas of humanities that are sensitive to language and tone. So it's really picking what I think are the most useful methodologies from other areas, the ones that get the best results out of the sources I have.
I think one of the things that's very distinctive about history is the fact that we do pinch methodologies
from all over. Yes, that it is quite an open discipline to these kinds of things, and that I think is an excellent thing. As soon as we try and say this is the way we do history, and constrain it into one particular path, then suddenly we limit ourselves in what we can do and the type of questions we can answer.
So you mentioned that you do a lot too with money and accounts, and now I still don't really get early modern currency and financial system. So how do you deal with the challenge of the fact that it's so different when you're doing the kind of counting and
it is a challenge. I guess what I could say there is that although these are very complex systems, they're still based in quite simple principles. And the complexity comes from the fact there's a lot of simple principles interacting in different ways. So, you know, nowadays we're used to dealing still with different types of money, and with changing money, and with the idea that you can take advantage of differences in currency, things like that. Now, in the early modern period, there's obviously a much greater number of currencies, there's a much greater number of ways to take, or differences. But still, the principles are still the same, that you want to buy low in one place and sell high in the other. Mm-hmm. And then you can bring that to the sources and use that to read it through. So it is more complicated, but it's still, once you sort of find the thread, it's still quite easy to go through.
I'd say, like, once you become fluent in kind of those principles, I guess it starts to become more comprehensible.
Exactly. And in certain respects, it's easier to understand than it is today. There's still quite a close link at this time between the value of currency and the value of the coin that's part of them. So that provides certain baselines against which you can analyse these things.
Is it so? I mean, maybe you could tell us a bit about what are you doing your postdoctoral research on? Something to do with corruption and...
Corruption, yes. So I really have two projects. One is quite a broad project, it moves sort of beyond this specific postdoctoral project, which is how states operate during, say, the 16th to the 19th centuries. Mm-hmm. What changes in this time? How do states operate on the one hand and interact with politics and political institutions, and on the other hand with commercial and financial institutions? So that's the big project. The specific project here is looking at what I call mentalities of corruption in the 18th century. So this is, firstly, how does corruption operate at this time? What role does corruption serve? What purposes is it being used for? And that's in Britain, the British Isles, so Ireland and Scotland, and also hopefully in the wider empire, so the North Atlantic and in India. And the second is looking at how the people involved conceptualised what they were doing. I think we have a conception that people who are corrupt either are very cynical about it and don't care about the public service at all, or they compartmentalise their lives and never try and resolve the two. And I think that that's a slightly simplified version of what they're doing, that there are ways that people sought to reconcile what they're doing with an underlying moral code. And also that once we link that up with what purpose corruption served, more interesting things happen. So if corruption is not the wholly bad thing that we now think it is, then this obviously expands the number of ways people can conceptualise what we were doing. And even if nowadays we are very unsympathetic to corruption, quite rightly, of course, that's not very helpful when we look at the past, where obviously corruption was a far more complicated issue. So trying to recover what role corruption served in the 16th to the 19th centuries, and also how people thought about it, is going to enhance our study of the history of this time, and also potentially, going back to what we were saying earlier, other areas of the world where there may be some parallels that we can draw out about what role corruption serves there and how people conceptualise it.
No, so that sounds really interesting. Well, I think I wondered, you mentioned mentalities. So do you find then that with these kind of conceptualisation, I know it's at your early stage of your research, but do you find there's it's a very fluid concept, there's lots of different types of corruption and people, it's not the same for everyone?
Yes, absolutely. There are a number of ways in which people can explain away the corruption that they do. And I think the metaphor I normally use is to imagine a long line or a continuum where at the one end you have actions which are entirely honest and entirely moral and not corrupt at all, and on the other end, actions which are entirely corrupt and entirely built on personal aggrandizement and not public service. And in the middle, there are a number of things which are more or less driven by private profit and more or less driven by public service. And these can interact in various ways, people thinking that what they're doing is harmless, people saying that this is their corruption can even be a benefit to the state. And there's some quite interesting ways that people say that the service that they're providing for the state, in what I'm working on at the moment, the financial services they provide, is actually integral to how the state operates. It's useful to have it. And as a result, by being corrupt, they're actually serving the public, which is quite an interesting way of doing it. So yes, there's an enormous variety, and what we see is people picking and choosing between them in response to the kind of situations in which they find themselves, the audiences to which they're responding.
The one which makes them look best, I often find is invariably the case.
Yes, of course, and that is something that I think we can expect to see. Of course, people choose the explanations that make themselves look good. But I think we also have to take these at more than face value, that they're, for sure, there are people who lie and there are people who deceive in order to justify themselves. But there are still people who maybe are genuinely conceiving of their activities in this way, and who we can't just write off as hypocrites for saying this.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. That is an important point. It's very easy to kind of ascribe motives for people doing it, whereas I think oftentimes it is more genuine than disingenuous.
Yeah, precisely. I think we need to move away from what I certainly see as a rather 19th century view of this, that there is a line, and on one side is corruption, on the other side is public service, and you can place people in one or two of the others. I think this is really a far more complicated thing.
So as you're going through your kind of training as a historian, what were some of the historians that influenced you? They thought these are really good. I want to kind of maybe emulate them, take from them something. Was there any particular people that you think that inspired you or influenced you either?
Well, that's problematic. I wouldn't say there's a historian where I've seen them and I've said, right, I want to do exactly the same for this period. But there are certain historians whose work I've read and which has impressed me, and from whom I felt I could take certain things and use them for my own. So one of the classic works in the field is John Brewer's The Sinews of Power, which is, there's this classic study of the fiscal military state. Now, I disagree with actually rather a lot of what is said in there, but I think as an attempt to conceptualise the state and as an attempt to link up politics, bureaucracy, and even commerce and things like that, it's a really interesting step. So even as I disagree with a lot of it, I think I'm still defining myself in some measure against it. I've also been very impressed by David Hancock's work on 17th and 18th century mercantile networks. He's written a number of very, I think, impressive books that really dissect networks and show how commodities move through them. That rather than treating networks as just one circle of people, he shows how networks all interact with other ones. And that, although he works on mercantile networks and I'm more working on political and financial and administrative networks, that sense of seeing a network as a complete object rather than as something isolated from wider society has also been, I think, a very impressive thing, and also something I've tried to build on and carry through as I've been doing this work.
I think I was very impressed by Brewster's work. I think with a lot of it is, as you say, it's like you read and think this is really good, but they're wrong.
Well, I think that it's a certain point of view. Based on the sources that he looked at and things like that, this is the thing. You can only write really what you can from the sources that you see in the other historiography around. And I think in terms of where the field was in the 1980s, which said that Britain had no powerful state at all, to come in to the field and say, well, this is actually not the case, and there is a state here, even if I think the way he defines the state and the way he focuses on the excise rather than anything else is slightly problematic. It's a very good piece of work for all that.
Yeah, it is. So the final question, I guess, is another kind of broadness. Like, what advice would you give to kind of any budding future historians, like on how they should do history, from your experience?
Well, I'd certainly say there's no one way to do history. There are a variety of ways, some of which are more correct and more more sympathetic to this than others. But I think history, as we were saying earlier, is built on a variety of approaches. And I think really for historians starting out, and I'm not that far away from having started out myself, choosing a topic that is of interest, it is the most important thing, because I certainly found that in my own work, a lot of discoveries have just come from bashing away at a problem and trying it from various angles until finally something comes up, whether that is trying a new approach or tracking down this miscellaneous piece of correspondence that really unlocked everything. So I think choosing a subject in which you're interested, in which you're genuinely prepared as a result to dedicate a lot of time to, is really the only way forward. One shouldn't choose a subject because it's fashionable or because someone else tells you. You choose a subject that is profoundly interesting, and I think that's the most important thing that certainly I've taken away from studying, really from being an undergraduate onwards over the past few years.
I actually have another final question. Because you're at the start of your career as a historian, and so how have you found that process at the start? Have you found it challenging, or like what have been some of the highs and lows of it?
Well, it's been enormously challenging, enormously enjoyable as well. I think the greatest challenge has actually not been it's been really trying to make a series of steps, trying to move from the master's to the doctorate, from the doctorate to the next stage, which the postdoctoral research I'm now doing. And I think the competition for this is intense, and finding places to go and finding the money for them is becoming increasingly difficult. But also intellectually as well, moving up from the master's to the doctorate and moving up from being taught things to having to go and research things. And then even moving up from the doctorate, where you still have a supervisor, someone who can help guide you and shape what you're doing, to the postdoctoral project, where you really are on your own for the first time. Those have all been challenging, and I think coming together, rushing around in the last year of the doctorate, trying to find a new project, while at the same time finding a job and trying to stay in the profession, that was not a good combination of things. This comes back to what I was just saying, that if you are interested enough in the subject that you've chosen, then that kind of gives you the strength to carry through with these things. So I Even if most other people aren't interested in the financial intricacies of paying the army in the 18th century, I'm interested enough in them that I wanted to carry on, and that meant that I was willing to keep bashing my head against the wall until eventually the bricks broke.
Well, thank you ever so much for your time,
Dr.
Graham, and I for one look forward to your future research on finding out more about corruption and the changing conceptualization and mentalities of corruption in the long 18th century.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.